I was a Mormon child. And when you're a Mormon child, dreams are important. You're taught about them from the time you're tiny. You learn about Lehi at the beginning of the Book of Mormon, and he dreams of the Tree of Life. And you're taught about Joseph and the Baker King in the beginning. You're taught about the beginning of Mormonism when Joseph quivers under his bedsheets and the angel Moroni comes and visits him. And so when I had a dream, it didn't seem strange to me. It didn't seem strange at all. I had a dream. And in the dream that I had, there were two people that came to me. They were blonde, and they looked like my dad. It was a boy and it was a girl. It was a very intense dream. It was very strange and very intense. And the little boy came up to me, and he put his hands on my shoulders, and he looked me in the eyes, and he said, "You have to find me." And in the way of dreams, you don't question this. You just go along with it. You're like, yeah, sure, okay. I have to find you. And so I just said, okay, where are you? And he said, "We're in England." And the dream was over. And I woke up. And I figured, I didn't know what to make of this dream. I didn't think I had to make anything of this dream. It felt like an important dream. They looked like family. And Mormon children are taught that someday the spirit of Elijah is going to visit them. They're told songs about it. The hearts of the children will turn to their fathers. Malachi will prophesy it. So I thought, maybe these are ancestors. I'm supposed to find them someday, somehow. I don't know. I didn't think about it that hard. I didn't think about it until the day that I was 22 years old. And my husband and I found out we couldn't have children. We weren't just infertile. We were infertile. They told us that on a scale of 0 to 200, our fertility score was 0. Not like 0.1, not 0.2, like 0. We were never having a baby on our own. It was not happening. They told us that there was some hope of conception through a new procedure called intercytoplasmic sperm injection. I know, very fancy. My husband at the time was an NPR reporter. He made $21,000 a year. I was in grad school, and I looked up the price of in vitro fertilization, which was, at the time, $15,000 per cycle. Took on an average of 3 cycles, not covered by insurance. The intercytoplasmic sperm injection was on top of that. And I said, well, okay. And that's when I remembered this dream from years and years and years and years before. And on a whim, I remembered that a thing named Google had been invented. It had just been invented. And I got online and I Googled IVF in England. And I found out that in England, they had invented the drugs for IVF. And you could do a round of in vitro fertilization for $3,000. And not $15,000. And that seemed a little bit more doable, and I kept that in my mind. And the day I defended my master's dissertation, I walked out, and I had passed. People were congratulating me, and then a man walked up to me, and I didn't know him, and he wasn't talking to me about my thesis, which had to do with, like, alchemy and Arthurian legend, nothing to do with any of this thing. And he said to me, "I think you might be able to help me." And I was just like, I don't know who you are, but okay, I'm in a good mood. I just passed my master's defense. And he said, "I heard that you might be able to teach a writing class, and I need somebody to come with me to England." And I said, "I'm listening." And he's like, "I would take your husband too. It would be 6 weeks. The pay is $3,000. And I said, "I'm in. We'll go." There was a catch. It was a wilderness writing class. We were supposed to hike 7 mountains, 20 miles a day, more than 200 miles. I didn't care. I was in. So we go to London with the IVF clinic. The first thing that they do is they turn off your pituitary gland. Your pituitary gland not only regulates your hormones, which have the ability to control your hormones, but they have your ability to control your physical and emotional stress. So I was hiking 20 miles a day over 7 mountains with no ability to cope with physical or emotional stress. It got dark. I was struggling. It was rough. I started to have headaches. I started to see shadows out of the corner of my eyes. I started to see ghosts. I started to see things. I didn't feel right. I started to throw up. I went to the clinic and I told them, I'm seeing things. I don't know that I'm supposed to be seeing things. My head hurts. I don't know that I'm supposed to have these headaches. I don't know that I'm supposed to have these nightmares. I've been having these terrible nightmares. Is this normal? And they looked at me and they said, we're literally changing the chemistry of your brain. There is no normal. But also, we have never had a patient as young as you, ever. And this is Mormon problems. But we don't know what's going to happen. We don't have any idea what's going to happen. And in fact, if this is happening now, we need to stop. We need to stop. We need to not do this. And she looked at me, and her glasses were slipping off her face. She was sweating on her brow, and she said, you could have a stroke. We could give you cancer. The things that we are doing to you could haunt you for the rest of your life. In Celtic mythology, there is a myth, a legend, of the moment that one of the old gods comes to you. It's usually a goddess, and she makes you a bargain. In Wales, they call it the tonnid. In Ireland, they call it the gish. It's a blessing, but it comes at a cost. And in this moment with the doctor looking at me, telling me, we need to stop. We need to stop. We are going to hurt you. You are going to suffer for the rest of your life because you've made this decision. I made a decision, and I decided to lie. And I looked at her in the face, and I said, the headaches aren't that bad. They're just shadows that I'm seeing. I'm not really seeing anything. It's nothing really to worry about. If it's something to worry about, I will tell you, I promise, and we will stop. We will stop the moment it gets bad. And I said this knowing I was never going to tell her that it was bad. And one day we were on a 20-mile hike, and we were hiking to Milton Abbey, and we were in the woods, and they were in ancient woods, the kind of woods where you feel things that are watching you. They say that that the woods in England used to be haunted by lions, real lions. And you could feel them watching you. You could feel all kinds of ancient things watching you in these woods. And I felt so tired. And the ground was muddy. My feet were so heavy. I didn't feel like I could lift them. My shoes were caked in mud. I didn't know how I was going to keep stepping and stepping with the ground as heavy. It felt like the ground was trying to suck me back into it. My head hurt, and I was seeing things. And then suddenly, I saw myself. And she was standing in front of me, hovering in the air. And nobody else could see her. I knew that I was the only one. I knew I was seeing things. I knew this was my brain. I knew that something had gone wrong in my brain, and now I was seeing myself in front of myself. And she just looked at me, and I looked at her, and I kept walking. And she smiled. And then something in my stomach changed just a little bit. And she sort of smiled back, and she said, what do you want? Because I could give it to you. Do you want to be rich? Because I could make you rich. And I had never wanted to be rich. I was married to an NPR reporter. That was not something I thought about. Like, that was not a thing that was going to be happening. Like, we were not. But in that moment, I wanted to be rich. I felt it churning in my gut, like something like bloodlust. I wanted it. And she said, you could be powerful. And I wanted to be powerful. And she's like, your husband, he could be the prophet. You could walk into a room and people will listen. They'll listen to the sound of your voice and they'll cheer. And right at that moment, somebody bumped into me out of nowhere. And I had this sensation that they were all this moving stream of water and I was a rock and I was stuck and they were moving and they were moving and I didn't know how to get out of this river because I was stuck in the body and the girl who looked like me, the woman who looked like me, the spirit who looked at me, and she said, when you're rich and when you're powerful, nobody will bump into you. And I said, how? What's the price? And then she showed me an image. And I saw the girl that had just bumped into me. And there was a cliff up ahead. And I saw her fall. And I saw her falling down and down. And I saw hands pushing her. And then the orientation changed. And I looked and I saw my face, my hands pushing her. And I was smiling. And I startled. And I stopped. And I looked at the person that looked like me and I said, who are you? Because you're not me. And then she smiled once more and she faded into the trees. And we got to Milton Abbey and I was still so tired and we had to take off our shoes or our hiking boots because they were covered in mud. And so I was walking around this ancient, ancient church and I had wool socks on, and they were leaving wet footprints everywhere that I went. And there was a tour guide, and he was talking, and I vaguely heard him talk as I was walking and walking, exhausted, and it was cold, and I was shivering. Everything was cold, and I shivered, and I shook. And he told us about the abbey and what happened, and he said it was founded by Athelstan in the 10th century. Athelstan was walking in the woods, up in that hill, and he pointed to where we had just been. Athelstan was walking in those woods. He was going into battle, and then suddenly he had a vision. He saw himself. He saw himself standing there, and he saw himself winning. He saw himself not just winning, but becoming the first king of England, the only king of England that would unite it all under one banner. And he asked what would be the price. And the price was the abbey raised up high. It was a tonnage. It was a bargain. He went into battle and he won. And that was the story of the founding of the abbey. But the problem with a bargain that you make with the old gods is if you fail to keep up your end, destruction follows, and when he died, the abbey burned to the ground. Benedictines moved in and rebuilt it. But then Henry VIII came in, dissolved all of the monasteries, gave it to his friends. It was taken over by a man named Earl Dahmer. And Earl Dahmer was walking in the woods one day up near Milton Abbey, and he saw himself lording over the entire estate. There was a village there. He didn't think there should be a village there because he should be the king. He should be the one. So he went down because the price for him becoming the king was that there should be no village, and he raised it to the ground. And as the tour guide said this, I was standing in my wet socks, surrounded by names that were etched in stone of rich people who bought those stones with wealth that they couldn't take with them. And the chapel was cold with it. And I could hear their screams. I could smell the smoke that was 1,000 years old. After that, it was bought by a family named the Hambros. And the Hambros were one of those families that was partly titled, partly noble. Charles always wanted to be a noble. His entire life, he wanted nothing more than to be a noble. He had money. He didn't have a title. His beloved wife was a lady. And he knew he deserved his wife. He knew that he deserved to be her equal. He hated that he wasn't her equal. He would give anything to be her equal. He wanted to own Milton Abbey so that he could be her equal, and he bought it. And before they could move in, she died. He was knighted on the site, and one of the plaques that sits at Milton Abbey has her name, Pamela. And as the tour guide told us all these things, I started to wonder what happens when they mess with the chemicals of your brain. Do they tear away the veil that keeps the ghosts and the old gods from coming to you? Because when you make a bargain with an old god, you have to pay the price. And you have to be willing to pay the price, because the price always comes. And the reason that I'm sitting here instead of standing is that every terrible thing that that doctor warned me would happen did. Every horrible thing that she said would happen to me, because I made the choice to do what I did at 22, happened to me. And would I do it again? I have a little boy who's blonde and a little girl who's blonde, and they both look like my dad. And I would do it again in 1,000 lifetimes.